You could have a seat. Calling case number 85394, Wynn versus Nielsen. It's a time set for oral argument. Council, is everybody ready to proceed?
Good morning, Chief Justice, members of the court. Todd Bice on behalf of Stephen Wynn. I'd like to reserve 4 minutes for my rebuttal. The issue before this court is Nevada's anti-SLAPP statute and its proper application. Below, the district court conflated one and two and did so in a manner that we maintain violated Mr. Wynn's rights to a jury trial. We set that out in the briefing, as this court is aware. This case stems from Mr. Nielsen's contentions as essentially the sole on-the-source record about making allegations against Mr. Wynn. Now, Mr. Nielsen is entitled to criticize Mr. Wynn. He's entitled to hold him in disrepute because, as has been set out in the record, Mr. Nielsen actually did have a personal grudge with Mr. Wynn relating to his demotion at the company many years prior. But what the law doesn't allow, and where you cross that line, you're entitled to criticize, is when you make up things claiming that they happened when in fact they didn't happen. And in particular, offering money to people to say things happened, that crimes happened, that didn't happen. And in the record below, Mr. Wynn presented evidence that that's exactly what Mr. Nielsen did. In fact, there's sworn declarations from witnesses that said that Mr. Nielsen offered them money to make false allegations against Mr. Wynn of rape. That evidence has to be accepted as true. And by the way, Mr. Nielsen never denied it. I'm not saying he has to deny it at this stage of the proceedings, but he didn't. So what the district court did here is, upon remand, because this case was already before this court previously, what the district court said is it was bound by this court's findings, an appellate court, generally not a finder of fact, but nonetheless, the district court said it was bound by this court's findings under phase one of the SLAPP statute. I submit, under this court's jurisprudence, including the Chief Justice's recent opinion in Taylor versus Colon, that that's just wrong. There cannot be a binding determination in phase one consistent with the right to a jury trial under the Seventh Amendment or under Article I, Section 3 of this state's constitution.
Well, Mr. Bice,
yes.
Let's assume you're right, and yes, I've read Taylor as well,
yeah.
Obviously. But even if we're not relying on step one at the step two piece, and at this point, since our review is de novo, I think we can just focus on what the evidence shows rather than what the court held necessarily.
All right, very good, Justice Kagan. And let me turn to that. Because if phase two had been properly applied, Mr. Wynn presented evidence to the district court that did show the minimal merit. And I believe, Justice Kate Ish, it was your opinion in
Smith versus Ziegler, Zilber.
Right, reaffirmed that very principle, right? The plaintiff's burden is to show minimal merit. What Mr. Wynn presented here was evidence which must be accepted as true, right? And all inferences must be reasonably drawn in favor of the plaintiff. And that's where the district court, I submit, went very far awry. Even the district court says in its order that it conducted an independent review, but the actual record shows that the district court was weighing the evidence. It didn't acknowledge Mr. Wynn's evidence at all.
How does the evidence Mr. Wynn presented below show that the statements that were actually published and attributed to Mr. Nielsen are in fact false?
All right, so The statements that Mr. Nielsen published, where he accused Mr. Wynn of assaulting a manicurist by physically chasing that manicurist around in the spa. Mr. Wynn says that didn't happen. Other witnesses say that that would be impossible, including because of the fact that Mr. Wynn is legally blind, and he was not, in fact, chasing it. Now, what did Mr. Nielsen say when he was ultimately pressed on that in later acknowledgement and briefing? He didn't know whether that was true or not. He had been told that. Same thing with respect to these issues about he made the statements that false bookings were made in order to disguise Mr. Wynn's alleged harassment and in his misconduct at the spa. Again, one of the people responsible for those bookings says, that's not possible. That didn't happen. And Mr. Nielsen, by the way, also ends up having to acknowledge in his briefing, he doesn't know that. He's just repeating what he says other people conveyed to him. So here's the evidence, again, which the law says you can draw the inference that he had a reckless disregard for the truth or falsity because he had ill motive. Yes, actual malice and constitutional malice are not identical, but actual malice, ill will, as this court said in Posadas, is actual evidence from which the jury can infer that, in fact, you entertained substantial doubts about the accuracy of the statements that you were conveying. And as Professor Smola says in his treatise, which this court has cited at least a half a dozen times authoritatively, it is a classic disregard for the truth. If you convey facts, which in giving the appearance that you personally are the source of these facts, when in fact you don't know them to be true. That is classic disregard.
Mr. Rice, what do you hope to discover? Were a limited discovery allowed to go forward? What is it? What information are you hoping to, discover?
Sure. So the sort of secondary position on this is that we were deprived discovery again because the district court felt that it was bound to this court's original ruling. With respect to discovery, I think the most obvious is what Dr. Paligi had put forth in her declaration. Because remember, she didn't just sign a declaration attesting to this offer of a bribe to fabricate a charge of rape against Mr. Wynn. She also produced text messages, which showed, in fact, her communications. She was friends with Mr. Nielsen. So Mr. Nielsen is a user of text communications, and as Mr. Wynn has alleged, and as Ms. Scheipe also put in her declaration, Mr. Nielsen's statements conveyed the impression that he was working on behalf of Elaine Wynn, Mr. Wynn's ex-wife. This court knows the history. I don't remember how many appeals we were up here on during the shareholders litigation of the very bitter fight between Steve and Elaine. It's undisputed. There's a long history in this court about that litigation. But Ms. Scheipe and Dr. Paligi both make the point. He was acting on her behalf, trying to solicit people to make claims because she was then using that in the shareholder litigation. We believe that would further substantiate the fact that this was all part of an effort, an organized scheme, to trump up charges that Mr. Wynn disputes. That we were deprived of any ability to do that discovery, including obtaining copies of the text messages, which we believe would show that. The district court, again, denied us that right based on, largely on the assertion that it was, quote, bound. We weren't allowed to contest falsity because it was bound by this court's ruling in phase one. But turning back, if I might, to Justice Kadish, to your questions, it is when a witness is largely the sole source of the on-the-record statements, making allegations that the witness does not know is true, but the gist and sting of the statements are, he is an eyewitness to these events, right? He has a motive to fabricate. And I'm not saying that that's binding, I understand that, but for purposes of phase two, the evidence of his motive to fabricate and his involvement in activities to fabricate and the evidence that he was trying to fabricate is substantial evidence that he entertained actual doubts about the statements that he was making. Because why would you need to fabricate if, in fact, the statements that you were conveying were true? The jury is entitled to conclude the reason you were fabricating, Mr. Nielsen, the reason you were offering cash money to witnesses to perjure themselves is because you didn't actually have facts to support the contentions that you were making. That's why you went out into the world and offered these witnesses cash money. And remember, one of the statements that is in this case that the court relied upon during phase one was an anonymous declaration. And the court cited that and said it would have to accept that for purposes of phase one as being true. We don't know, and I'm not saying it's true. My point is, we don't know. Was that witness also offered money? We don't even know the name of the person. We know some witnesses were offered money in exchange for making the charge. That's the reason why we submit to the court. The district court was wrong. If the district court's approach under the SLAPP statute were proper and were sustained by this court, it would violate the Seventh Amendment. It would violate Section 1, Article 3, because it has deprived Mr. Wynn of the right of a jury trial on disputed issues of fact. It's in fact deprived him of even the ability to move forward with discovery on disputed issues of fact.
Mr. Bice, how would you suggest that the district court handled the determination made by this court on the first prong, if not to say that determination, that he already won, quote unquote, on that prong?
The first prong is did the defendant simply meet their burden, right? That's it. It's not a determination that whatever the plaintiff said was true. It is simply a did he meet his or her burden at phase one. This court said yes, they did, based on the totality of the evidence that was then before the court. That should have been it. It's not binding upon the phase two analysis, because if it were binding upon the phase two analysis, then under the chief's opinion in the Taylor versus Colon, that would violate the right to a jury trial, because you're using the phase one findings to bind the litigant. And so I see I'm out of time. I thank the court, unless you have any further questions for me. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Joel Henry Odd, on behalf of respondent Jan Nielsen, here with my co-counsel Danielle Barraza. I'm standing today in the stead of our friend Franny Forsman, who, like our lead counsel Kathleen England, couldn't be here with us today, but would love to have been. let me start by emphasizing a few points that I hope are absolutely clear. One, the district court did do an independent analysis in the second prong. She said she was doing an independent analysis. She mentioned this court's order, and that she was adopting it, but went immediately on to saying that she was doing an independent analysis. She referred to this court's opinions in Coker versus Sassone, and even the standard from Taylor versus Colon. She laid out the elements for defamation and then summarized the affidavits, the showing that Mr. Wynn had put forward, and then concluded that it would not be enough, even construing that charitably, for him to make his second prong showing. And the district court, even if this court were to apply a de novo summary judgment standard in reviewing the district court's order, it would stand. Now, the law here, I think, is a little unclear as to exactly what that standard is. Certainly, we've read the court's opinions that adopt California law that effectively makes it a summary judgment standard. It's not the actual language of the statute, which seems to require a probability of prevailing, which is different, materially different, from looking for just disputations of fact on material issues. But even if the court were to do just a summary judgment standard, this order would be affirmed. And on discovery, you're not entitled to discovery in every anti-SLAPP proceeding. And to say that you need to at least depose the defendant in an anti-SLAPP proceeding raising a defamation claim, that would be an exception that swallows the rule. It would apply in every single case. Here, the district court found, relying on California cases, that malice discovery would not be appropriate unless Mr. Nguyen had made a showing on prima facie evidence of falsity.
Well, what about the two statements brought up by Mr. Bice counsel about, you know, chasing the manicurist around and the impossibility of the scheduling, you know, chicanery? What about those? Are those genuine issues of material fact that are being challenged by Mr. Nguyen?
So, no, Justice Lee, I don't believe so, for a couple of reasons. One, chasing around. He never said, Mr. Nielsen never said that Mr. Nguyen assaulted anyone. He never said that he physically chased anyone around. Chased is a colorful verb. I think it includes a spectrum of things, from children chasing each other around physically on a playground, certainly a card chase. But if I don't pay my credit card bills, I'm going to get hounded by that credit card company with phone calls every day. And I think chasing is an accurate word for what they're doing when they call me every day. But if Mr. Nguyen is going down, for instance,
Isn't that contrary, though, to the concept that we look at the gist of the statement rather than parse the fine language? And here the gist of the chasing allegation is that he was physically going after people in the salon. And I think Mr. Bice's point is Nguyen denies that in his affidavit quite clearly and makes the point that he's blind and the salon isn't structured to accommodate chasing, both of which facts should have been known to the declarant, your client, and therefore casting doubt, given his offers of money to someone else, that's enough to get past the bar into discovery and allow him that right.
So I don't think physical chasing is necessarily the gist of that term. And that's why I set out the other examples of what it means. And to say that it's false would mean that every use of the term is false. He didn't say physically. The reason I don't lead with what the gist is, because I think it clearly is within the gist. I think that was the point of this court's holding in prior to remand. Is that the gist was true.
What was Mr. Nguyen allegedly doing?
So I think chasing can include going in, inquiring after someone doggedly, calling after that person doggedly. I want this person and only this person. Is that person there today? Is this person in the back? I want this person. And would that woman feel chased?
Sorry.
I can't say she wouldn't.
Mr. Bice said something to the effect that in the court proceedings that Mr. Nielsen had acknowledged he hadn't actually seen this and it was reported to him. Is that in the record?
Yes. Yes, that is in the record. He's not saying that he had firsthand knowledge of all of these things when he was talking to the reporter, when, yes, he was the whistleblower. He had worked there for many, many years. And had associations with many, many employees. The Wall Street Journal said that dozens of women, even in that initial story, that dozens of women had talked to him about this. So
let me ask you, Mr. Henriot, if I might go back to the discovery issue, because to be honest, it's very troubling to me that limited discovery wasn't granted. To begin with, our order to the district court said, district court, decide whether limited discovery is appropriate. And the district court then appears to say limited discovery is not appropriate because the Supreme Court said so. I'm bound by the Supreme Court's findings, instead of independently deciding whether it was appropriate. And everybody has said in district court on motions for summary judgment where one side says, under Rule 56, I'd like to do some discovery, and the other side says, no amount of discovery is going to change anything. And then, lo and behold, some discovery changes something. Like maybe discovery illuminates what chasing really meant in the context of what's being alleged here. So how is it just not really prejudicial error to have not allowed some limited discovery before proceeding on this?
So the court does acknowledge, the district court did acknowledge certainly this court's order and that it was bound. But I think in addition to that, the district court also looked at the prima facie showing on falsity. And with the 56 affidavit, right, when you say I need more discovery, you need to set out what it is you would do discovery on and what that would show. Here, they wanted to take the defendant's deposition. They wanted to unmask June Doe, who had a right under the EEOC investigation to remain confidential, although she was willing to come forward to the court. That the district court, I think, did not abuse its discretion in finding that that would not have moved the needle on falsity, objectively. Note what they were not asking for. They were not asking for records from the HR department on the properties. They were not asking to depose any executives or managers or people who would be able to confirm, yes, we've never received any complaints like this. We have no idea what he's talking about. And even those people would not have been conclusive on whether or not the events happened, because so much does go unreported. But at least it would be meaningful if the HR department were to confirm that they had never had any complaints like this. They didn't want that kind of discovery. All they wanted to do was examine the defendant. And in Nevada, that grants substantive immunity when the district court finds good faith from civil actions based on those communications, the point of the statute is to protect people from being badgered in the litigation itself. You have to, and this is the rationale of the California courts, who say that in order to do discovery, you can depose the defendant on malice, but you can and should prove a prima facie showing on falsity first. Here, they had ways of doing that. They did not want to do that. They certainly didn't ask to do that.
But let's circle back to the chasing episode. The statement from your client was, Wynn was actually chasing one of the managers around the salon, then she locked herself in the bathroom and would not come out. It strikes me that that's a pretty lurid statement to make. He wanted to talk to your client about what he knew and what he was envisioning when he made that statement to show actual malice. And that would have been the point of the deposition. And I associate myself with Justice Herndon's question. I'm concerned about the lack of discovery and the lack of ability to take that deposition and ask him the questions that all of us are debating today about what was going on with this chasing allegation. Why should that not have been allowed?
Well, again, because I do think it goes to malice. And malice as opposed to falsity, because if he reasonably believed it was true, or at least was not reckless to a high probability that it wasn't, then you don't have the showing even for actual malice.
But knowing that he had this condition that caused him to be essentially blind, doesn't that demonstrate knowledge of the falsity, or at least recklessness? He knew who Mr. Wynn was. He knew what his condition was.
I think perhaps only if you assume the most extreme interpretation of Chase, which I don't think is appropriate in this context.
As Justice Pickering noted, actually Chase.
So he would have to really know. And again, I think that there is a reasonable interpretation of that that would make it true, certainly not demonstrably false. The other thing on the false booking, if somebody says, Mr. Wynn, that person is already busy today, the statement is true. It doesn't technically mean in the system the way that Mrs. Scheipe says, well, that's not possible to actually do this booking that is never confirmed. Mr. Wynn says, nobody sent two people up to work on me or more if I didn't ask them. But a deft manager knows how to suggest. Mr. Wynn, while you're having your hair done, may we also send somebody up to do your nails? Certainly, that would be great. It is true at the same time that one person suggests it and the other person is saying, only because I wanted it. Now, this idea that Mr. Nielsen asked somebody to lie under oath, to come forward and say she was raped when that was false, it would not take long to read these affidavits. It's only about 5 pages of reading. I would suggest reading it very carefully. She does not say, neither of them say, that he asked her to lie. What they say, and I'm crediting this as true and giving reasonable inferences, even though we find it very dubious, even what's said, and he would emphatically deny quite a bit of what is in these affidavits. But even if you look at them charitably, what she says is, he invited me to say that I was raped, and then later on in the affidavit, that didn't happen. It wasn't. He's not saying, come forward and say you were raped, even though we know that's not true.
And apparently offered money on behalf of Mrs. Wynn.
Well, that or defense costs, I'm not sure exactly, but no, I do not think that he necessarily was saying somebody will pay you cash for this story. But he also, those depositions do not even suggest that if he did ask her to say, hey, reporters are going to be calling around, they're calling a lot of people, you may want to count that you were raped, it does not say that he thought that was untrue. Right? So what you have is you have a situation where reporters are calling around. If you have a story to tell, tell it. She says that wasn't true. She does not say he knew that was not true.
Isn't the report of that conversation, though, is that not enough to get a prima facie showing that maybe, in fact, this is the kind of conversations he was having with the other people who did speak to the reporters?
What kind of conversation? The kind of conversation where he's accused?
Offering money to accuse Mr. Wynn of lying. I apologize. Chief, can I get an answer? Thank you.
So, again, this, even if you credit her affidavit, she does not say that he had reason to believe that was false when he suggested she come forward with that story. If that is enough, if the anti-SLAPP protection, respectfully, is watered down to that point, then really what you have is an evisceration of the purpose of the statute, because billionaire bullies can still say, you better not say a word, because if there is any color to the words you use, if there is the slightest inconsistency, and I can show that you don't like me, that is enough for me to tie this up for years through trial. That is not what the legislature intended.
All right, thank you, Mr. Henrion.
Thank you. I think, you know, my friend, Mr. Henrod, the debate that he wants to have about what does chase mean, I think nicely illustrates the point. That's a disputed issue of fact.
Mr. Rice?
Yes.
Looking at the affidavit of Mr. Wynn, I'm really struck. If the gist of the statements is that he was harassing female employees of the salon, what seems to be completely absent from his affidavit is any denial of that.
I disagree with that, Justice Bell. I think the gist of the allegations that Mr. Nielsen relayed was actually assaults of employees at the salon, and Mr. Wynn does deny that. And in fact, if you look at what Mr. Nielsen is reported to have told the various news outlets, again, the whole chasing thing I think nicely illustrates it. Under the law, right, if it is capable of defamatory meaning, it is up to the jury. And the fact that my friend Mr. Henrod wants to debate what does chase mean under these circumstances illustrates that is an issue that would be
Where
presented.
Where in his affidavit does he deny assaults?
I'm sorry?
where in Mr. Wynn's affidavit does he deny having assaulted these women?
I don't have it in front of me. I can pull it up, but I believe that he did deny that. And I believe, for example, he denied this issue about chasing anyone around the...
He said he never chased any person.
Correct.
Got it.
But that's, of course, chasing someone, where they lock themselves in to a room, is an assault, right? If someone did that, and the police were summoned, right, that would be charged as an assault. Okay, that is disputed. And that actually, again, just like the debate that my friend wants to have about, well, what was the offer of money? Again, that illustrates the point that these are questions that a jury would have to resolve, because the allegations that Mr. Nielsen made, which he now concedes, he doesn't really know. He just says, well, I heard these things, right? Even though he knew Mr. Wynn was blind, there's no need to offer people money. If in fact, to give statements, if in fact you know that you don't doubt these things, that's why our point here is very straightforward. These are disputed issues of fact that the Constitution guarantees
what
a party.
What evidence is there that Mr. Nielsen did not believe the statements that he made to these press outlets?
The evidence is that he knew Mr. Wynn was blind.
Okay.
The evidence is that he offered money to people to fabricate the very charges that he now claims.
One person about a statement that's not part of the published statements.
I'm sorry?
Crediting that conversation, it was with Ms. Dr.
Paligi? Yeah.
And that is not the source of any of the statements that were actually in the article.
Well, I guess, yes, that is certainly true, because she didn't agree to do it. Number one, as she says, all right? But number two, again, it's not just direct evidence, Justice Kadish, that, you know, Mr. Wynn's evidence must be credited as true, and all reasonable inference that can be drawn from that evidence must also be credited as true. And the disputes then must be resolved by the jury. And that process was cut off here.
May I ask one more question?
Certainly. So in terms of knowing the statements that he was making were ostensibly false by Mr. Nielsen, do you take into consideration at all the findings by the Gaming Commission, the public apology by the CEO when the affidavit of the June Doe and the other victims who came forward to complain about this type of conduct? Given the cumulative nature of all of those things, would Mr. Nielsen have a reason to believe the falsity of the statements that he was making?
So the answer to that is no. Can the court, in other words, weigh these disputed issues that involve the company? No, I do not think that the court can weigh that and just decide that because there have been other proceedings where certain findings were made, which Mr. Wynn was not a party to, right, that those are somehow, well, there's enough smoke here where whatever Mr. Nielsen said should just somehow be accepted. That cannot be our laws, right? So I'll give you another example that is in the record, right? One of the things they relied upon below was the claim that Mr. Wynn had filed against Attorney Lisa Bloom. Well, the Ninth Circuit determined that Attorney Bloom had, in fact, fabricated certain witness statements alleging Mr. Wynn had engaged in improprieties with respect to employees. And in fact, it is also in the record that Ms. Bloom had to issue an apology to Mr. Wynn and pay a monetary settlement to him over this. Examples can be cited of making accusations against Mr. Wynn. Mr. Wynn can cite examples where he's been wrongly accused and prevailed. So, no, that's why we have trials. That's why the jury gets to hear all of the evidence and decide who's telling the truth here. Is Mr. Nielsen telling the truth? I apologize. So, Justice Pickering, I didn't know if you had a question.
No, Justice
okay.
Lee got it.
Right. All right. I'm out of time. I'm well over time, and my apologies to the Chief and the members of the Board.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Bice. This matter will stand.